Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 176 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling Thrust and Parry. WSU economist Randy Fortenberry takes on wheat and the world's woes. About the first part of my conversation with the Thomas B. Mick Chair in Economics at Washington State University. The chair, named after former WGC CEO Tom Mick, was funded with a $2 million endowment in 2009 that was money well spent, if you ask me. Fortenberry, who arrived in Pullman in 2011, is an excellent resource to the grain industry, and he only gets better the longer he spends in the Pacific Northwest. That's because, as Fortenberry points out, the Pacific Northwest is a special place. Not only do we export upwards of 90% of our wheat production, but we grow a specialty wheat, soft white, that is not readily replaceable on the world market. If you want to produce high-quality, consistent sponge cakes, cookies, and crackers, anyway. Before I get to the show, exciting news! The WGC has a newly designed website extolling the values of Washington wheat, as well as highlighting the Wheat All About It podcast. View the new website at wagrains.org. You can access podcast information on the homepage by scrolling down or by clicking on podcasts in the drop-down menu at the top of the page. With so many episodes in the archive, I'm choosing one each month to feature as a bonus episode. The first selection harkens back to episode 99, the most listened to episode in the library, entitled Howard Nelson's Hunt, Seeking the Elusive Eastern Washington Alternative Crop. Nelson recently retired from his position at Highline Grain, but episode 99 remains on the job. If you haven't already, give it a listen. All old episodes are on a scroll that is easy to navigate, so please go back and listen to earlier shows while you're driving a truck, sedan, or combine. They have all aged well, and the information and messages conveyed are just as applicable now as the day I produced them. Fortenberry and I spoke from our homes via a computer connection on May 1st, 2020. I'm posting this episode on May 5th, which is a quick turnaround for me, but I felt it was important listeners heard his comments as soon as possible, given how quickly the pandemic is impacting so many sectors of the global economy. The Northwest has much to be thankful for in terms of our wheat market, but the region's farmers are still part of a globally traded commodity with globally determined prices, albeit with soft white receiving a premium based on its class and quality. I began my interview with Fortenberry by reminding him that in 2010-11, Russia embargoed exports and wheat prices went through the roof. I'm sure listeners with grain to sell remember 2012. It was a very good year. Just last month, in late April 2020, Russia again announced it would embargo wheat exports due to domestic price concerns, and the world wheat price fell. I asked Fortenberry to reconcile the different outcomes from the different embargoes.
A couple of things. One, that was a very different time period. If you think back there, in the U.S., our carryout at the end of the marketing year was less than 30% stocks-to-use ratio. In other words, what we had left over going into the next harvest was less than 30% of total annual consumption. Now we're closer to 44 or 45%. So there's just a lot more wheat in the U.S., but that's also true globally. In the World Ag Supply-Demand estimates that were released in April, I think April 9th, of this year, USDA again increased world supply by about 10%. So we have a record amount of wheat in the world market, and it's dispersed geographically across the entire globe. So it's just a very different situation. In addition, it looks like the EU is in a position to just step up and fill the export reduction that Russia is imposing. So we have a reduction in consumption globally. We have global world stocks, and so there's plenty of wheat to move into the market if one particular exporter decides that they don't want to participate.
It's been more than one exporter. I mean, Romania is not a big exporter, but it's in there. And Ukraine, in the middle of the month that it was slashing exports. I'm only a casual observer in all of this, but it appears that what you're saying is nobody is worried where their wheat is going to come from.
No, I think that's true. I mean, you know, some of the high-end buyers might be worried if they're buying soft white wheat, but in general, for the wheat market, it's not an issue. And while there have been reductions in exports, total trade has been reduced based on USDA's most recent outlook, but part of that is a reduction in consumption. So the expectation is that China is going to reduce its consumption by 2 million tons this year, India about 1.9 million tons, the EU a million tons. Even in the U.S., we've lowered feed use significantly. So part of this is a reaction to relatively poor prices, which are partly a function of reduced demand.
Well, wait a second. Reduced prices, you would think that that would increase consumption. Is COVID-19 playing into this in terms of reduced consumption?
Well, partially, but the thing is, you have causality going both directions. So if prices fall dramatically, you expect consumption to go up. But if consumption is reduced, then prices are going to respond by going down. And so what's happening is we have, partly because of COVID, in China, for example, it's probably a result of consumer demand, which might be COVID-related, probably is COVID-related. But if everybody's consuming less and supply is growing at the same time, you're going to have a negative price response.
So, Randy, after interviewing you a number of times over the years and attending your presentations, I've come to believe that you, more than most, really consider currency valuations perhaps as much as supply and demand. Now, what makes the dollar stronger and what makes it weaker, and which is better overall?
Okay, yeah, that's a really challenging question. First of all, I'm going to argue that actually looking at currencies is part of supply-demand, because a change in currency value for an importer changes the final price they pay. So it is part of the price that ends up being paid by a final consumer. When we export wheat to Japan, for example, what the final consumer pays is not just a function of what the price is at Portland plus transportation, but the cost of converting yen to U.S. dollars to pay the exporter out of Portland. So it is part of the supply-demand picture. If you think about U.S. wheat in general, about 45-46% of our wheat goes to the export market. But in the Pacific Northwest, it's closer to 90%. So I probably pay more attention to exchange rates than maybe wheat analysts from Kansas or even from the Midwest and the soft red winter wheat producing areas, because almost all of our wheat's going overseas. And so exchange rates really affect our trading opportunities. What makes a currency stronger or weaker is a relative demand to hold that currency at the expense of a different currency. And historically, the dollar has been viewed as a relatively safe place to hold your wealth in times of economic uncertainty. So often when we have a disruption in the world economy or some sort of a shock, the value of the dollar will appreciate because international companies and countries will be converting their currency to hold U.S. dollars as they go through that transition period or absorb whatever the shock is. And so the demand to, let's say, sell yen and buy dollars will result in the value of the yen relative to the dollar going down, making the dollar relatively more expensive. Whether a weaker or a stronger currency is good or bad really depends on who you are. Because the U.S. is a large net importer, our balance of trade is quite negative. We import much more than we export on a value basis. Then for U.S. consumers, a stronger dollar is better for them than a weaker dollar, because when they're buying things like cellular phones or automobiles that are imported, the U.S. dollar buys more of the currency from the importing country, making that product less expensive than it would be if the dollar were weaker, and it would take more dollars to buy that foreign currency. But if you're an exporter, which in agriculture we are net exporters, it's the exact opposite. A stronger dollar makes your product more expensive to the importing country, and eventually more expensive to the consumer in that importing country as it goes through transportation, processing, whatever has to happen to get that product to the final consumer. And that makes exports more challenging and less competitive with other countries that might have a weaker currency. For some commodities where we dominate the world market, it's a little less sensitive. But for wheat, where it's grown almost everywhere, and we have 5 or 6 or 7 major exporters that we're always competing with, the relative value of our currency with those other exporters helps determine whether we are or are not competitive in the global market. And the relative value of our currency with our importer customers determines whether or not wheat is more expensive or less expensive for them at their shoreline.
Does that make the United States at this point, with a strong dollar, the exporter of last resort?
Well, it can for some commodities, and in fact, wheat might be one of those. Now, again, soft white wheat is a very unique product, so we don't have a lot of competition for that class, so we can absorb a little more of a currency fluctuation before we see market share disappear. But for wheat in general, when we categorize all the classes of wheat, then we will become a market of last resort if the U.S. dollar appreciates too much. But there's other things that are going on too. Quality matters. The ability to be a reliable supplier matters. Cost of getting your product to the export terminal matters. So if you had a country that had to pay a significant amount, a premium for transportation to a port, then an increase in the value of the dollar could still be attractive to a particular buyer because we're still cheaper when we have if we have lower transportation costs. So there's a lot of things that figure in there. But all else equal, as the dollar tends to gain in value, we become a less attractive supplier to international customers.
Okay, now, Randy, we are pumping trillions of dollars into the economy. And, you know, the little bit I know about economics is that when you pump all this money in, inflation happens and the value of your currency goes down. But I haven't heard anything about inflation.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. It's interesting because that would be the, I guess what I would say, historically, that would have been the common interpretation of pumping all that money into the economy. Interestingly, when we did the same thing in the Great Recession, the 2007 through 2009 period, and we bailed out large industries, the automotive industry specifically, and the banking sector, and we also printed a lot of money at that time, there were a lot of forecasts that we would see significant inflation later, and it really just didn't materialize. And so there's a little bit of some uncertainty about what the overall impact is. Certainly it is would consider to be inflationary under normal circumstances, all else equal. However, inflationary doesn't necessarily mean your currency devalues, because if your interest rates rise as a result of inflation and your interest rates become more attractive than interest rates in, let's say, the EU or Asia, some other location, then there'll still be demand to buy U.S. dollars and deposit them in U.S. banks because they'll earn a higher return over time with those higher interest rates than they would if they were sitting in a bank with relatively low interest rates. Back when the Fed raised interest rates a while ago, coming out of the Great Recession, we did see the dollar strengthen because we started to see euros and Asian currencies being converted into dollars to be deposited in U.S. banks. So inflation impacts interest rates, and higher interest rates relative to other countries will tend to result in a stronger local currency.
I don't want to get bogged down in this too much, but are basically the economic books being rewritten? Because it seems to me that in the past, it was just a given that you pump all this money in. I mean, like Venezuela, for instance, it's remarkable to me that we can do this. And I'm going to ask you another question later on about the trillions that we're pumping in, but it just, you know, does not compute.
I'd be careful about saying that the economic theories are being rewritten. In most theories like this, the timeline isn't clearly delineated. So the fact that maybe it's taken a bit longer than we anticipated back coming out again out of the Great Recession doesn't necessarily mean it's not something that will eventually occur. It just didn't happen as quickly as some people were anticipating it might.
Okay, let's go back to Russia for a moment. So what does the Russian ruble look like compared to the dollar? Is it gaining strength, losing strength, and why?
Okay, so that's a really good question. If we go back to about the middle of March, so let's say 6 weeks ago, the U.S. dollar's gained about 6% relative to the ruble. But it's down a bit relative to, say, 1 month ago. So there's been a lot of volatility. What was happening from the 1st of January up through sort of the where we began to shut down the U.S. economy towards the end of February, we started to get stay-at-home orders, and some of the states and cities started to react to the coronavirus situation. When that happened, the dollar depreciated relative to the ruble significantly. But it happened in a very short period of time, over about 2 or 3 weeks. And then it gained in strength significantly over the next couple of weeks. And now we've been hanging around kind of in this same area for about a month. But it is significantly stronger relative to the ruble than it was at the beginning of the year, and much stronger than it was in early March.
Okay. So with countries curtailing exports, we've got Russia, we've got Ukraine, we've got Romania. Is there any possibility of us getting back into the Egyptian market?
That's a good question. It's a little, certainly probably not this crop year. Interestingly, you know, if you look up through last week anyway, total wheat sent to Egypt from the United States was like, I think just over 100,000 metric tons, where last year it was over 600,000 metric tons. So we haven't been sending anything to Egypt thus far. Egypt likes to buy on price more than quality, and certainly the Eastern European countries have an advantage to getting into Egypt. But the problem right now is, if you believe the USDA World Ag Supply Demand Estimates, is that the European Union is increasing exports at about the same volume that Russia itself is decreasing exports. So the EU has an advantage to get into that market as well. So at least over the next 2 or 3 months, it's hard for me to envision Egypt suddenly becomes a large buyer of U.S. wheat, replacing what they were getting from Eastern European countries. If that happens, it'll probably be coming out of the EU.
Okay. I read recently that it is difficult to gauge trade flows during a pandemic. What does that mean, and why is it important?
Well, there's all kinds of things that factor into that. One of them is, if you happen to be a community that's suffering significant impacts from the pandemic, then it may well affect demand for food. And so trying to anticipate how demand is going to change as an importer is challenging. Secondly, you have the potential to disrupt the supply chain. The way that we transport food around the world can be disrupted. If you think about that, hasn't really happened yet with large ocean-going vessels. But if you think about suppliers that rely on air traffic, and significant number of industries do have supply chains where air traffic is an important part of their movement, suddenly the U.S. airlines refuse to fly to China, and a large part of some of, for example, the U.S. bicycle industry would get parts from China that would often come in the bellies of passenger aircraft. Well, suddenly that movement doesn't exist. So the question is, how do you replace that supply chain? Does it come from the same area but by a different mode of transportation? Do you resource it somewhere else? So sort of figuring all those things out becomes quite challenging. And then the third possible situation is, in the interest of food, especially for food security, do we have things like Russia, where suddenly they just, at any price, decide they don't want to be participating in the international market? So sort of putting all those things together, what happens to overall demand? Consumer demand as the pandemic affects the population. How do supply chains get disrupted as logistics are interrupted, and trying to figure out what will be the substitute for current supply chains or transportation modes? And then on the supply side, whether political entities, whether it's countries or cities or counties or whatever it happens to be, if they decide to try and store or hold back commodities that they otherwise would be trading freely, that becomes challenging to anticipate. So putting all that together and trying to figure out how trade flows change is quite a challenge.
I talked to a farmer just the other day, and this doesn't have anything to do with food, but he went in to get a part, and the part wasn't available at the store. The part wasn't available in Spokane. The part wasn't available in Washington. The part was not available. Are you concerned at all, or do you think this thing is going to be over quickly enough that we won't have these problems with supplies of essential parts that farmers need.
I don't know that it's going to be over quickly enough to solve some of those issues. We've seen fluctuations, and we've seen regional issues. So, for example, just think about the toilet paper situation. For a number of weeks, it simply wasn't available in any of the grocery stores that I shop at. I went in last week, and suddenly the shelf wasn't full, but there was quite a bit there. So part of it is the logistics of the supply chain catching up to getting it to the final consumer. Right now, a huge concern with red meat in the U.S., if these packing plants don't go back online, people have talked about, I'm not going to say a shortage, there could be local shortages, but certainly increased scarcity, so less meat, less variety available at the retail level. But it's not because we don't have meat, it's backing up at the farm level. It's more about getting it delivered to and through a processing facility and then delivering it to the retail consumer. So just because it's not available at the retail level at a specific location doesn't mean we don't have it. It means we're having trouble getting it to the right location. And I'm not sure that's something that will just disappear here in the next 3 or 4 weeks as we open up the economy.
We are plowing new ground, folks, and nobody knows exactly how it will all play out. I tell my daughters they should all be keeping a journal because we are living through an historic moment. Fortenberry and I continue our conversation in part two when we discuss corn prices and their influence on wheat, the dangers of food nationalism, and how he's anticipating what a post-COVID-19 world will look like. I notice episodes with two parts frequently don't see as many listeners in the second part. Folks, I'm here to tell you, Fortenberry and I are just getting started. Please join me here again next week with the episode I entitled Thrust and Parry. WSU economist Randy Fortenberry takes on wheat and the world's woes. 2. Right here on Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat. A miracle of nature that we just call wheat. History of starvation in times of want and woe. Wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.